All right, another episode here of Whiskey Throttle Radio. On this show, we have Venezuelan rider Anthony Rodriguez on to talk about his 2019 Supercross season, his new adventures in mountain biking, and his plans for the summer. Also on the show is the owner of Task Racing. It's Mark Slover. Task Racing makes high-quality helmet lights, bike lights, and they're kind of venturing off into some other things now, too. But it was really cool to pick his brain and learn a lot more about his company. As always, huge thanks to our sponsors. Blood Lubricants continues to support this show, and I can't thank them enough. And, you know, makers of high-quality racing oil, degreaser, chain lube, they have it all. So make sure to check them out at bloodlubricants.com and use the promo code WHISKEY for 25% off. Also, huge thanks to Task Racing. Mark's a real cool dude and helping support the show. And, yeah, thank you to them. TaskRacing.com, really high-quality bike lights and helmet lights. And then last but not least, Risk Racing, innovative motocross products. Check them all out at RiskRacing.com. As always, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Showtime. Me right now is a rider out of Venezuela. It's Anthony Rodriguez. What's up, man?
Not much, man. How you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, just another weekday, getting ready for the weekend.
Sounds good. Same here.
So, you know, jumping right into it, let's talk about your Supercross season this year. Some ups and downs. Obviously, started out as a full, you know, privateer. I saw you pulling in Daytona with your truck and pretty much just your bike and gear bag. Take us through the season and how you ended up getting that ride with Ty Lube.
Okay, so if there was one word to explain my season, that would have been a mess. I came back from Europe doing really good. In three different motos, I was able to get fourth places in the GP as a feeling rider. You know, that's a good thing to do, especially when you jump into a season where all the guys are fit and race ready, and I just came out of nowhere with zero preparation, and then I had to play the catch-up game. I ended up doing really good. So long story short, I came to America back from Europe, and I was dealing over there trying to get a 450 ride. I was aged out of the 250 class in Europe since you have to be 22 in January 1st. And so that was my main focus at the time because I had done so good in Europe. I kind of wanted to stay there. And so I wasn't really getting ready to do Supercross as a privateer, and then nothing ended up happening, either in the U.S. or Europe, and I was left with nothing. And there was, like, a period of time where I was just doing gym only the entire time, and I was trying to stay fit, but I wasn't riding a dirt bike because I didn't have one.
Okay.
And then it was, like, 3 weeks left before the first East Coast round. And one of my friends, Keith Docker, retired from racing, and a light bulb came up in my head, and I'm like, hey, he's got a bike that's race-ready, a Yamaha that David Walls built that was basically the same bike that I rode in 2017 when I did it as a privateer. And so I bought that from him. I basically put in 2 weeks of riding. You know, I rode his suspension, and then that's when I did those rounds in the Yamaha. Unfortunately, at Daytona, I had that crash, and I decided it wasn't a smart idea to race that night, especially because I was just racing because I wanted to keep my name on the table. I was not ready. I had very few days of riding. I was just desperate. I wanted to be out there. But in reality, I shouldn't have been out there because I wasn't fully ready, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Ty Lube thing actually came around right about Daytona time. I was talking to Buddy at the gate, basically, before my heat race started, and he was trying to explain to me what was going on, and then we caught up after the race. He told me exactly what was going on, and I was like, you know what, like, I was going to be done after Daytona because I didn't have money to continue racing all the rounds. So I was like, I'd rather get to the races and do the best I can rather than be on the couch waiting for a phone call. So I got the bike from Blake Wharton because he was the guy that I was filling in for. He's a lot lighter than me, so the suspension did not work at all. I ended up getting suspension that was somehow really good without testing, but it was only 2 days before Nashville. So basically, I went to Nashville with 1 day of riding on the bike, and, you know, I was able to do one fast lap. I can do that, but do that consistently on a bike that you don't know how it's going to react to bumps or whoops, et cetera, makes it hard on your body. And so I was making a lot of mistakes that day. I had some close calls to some hard crashes, and I was like, you know what, this is not smart. I'm going to take this weekend off. The team knows I've only been on the bike for 2 days because, unfortunately, suspension was lost by UPS. And so everything was just a mess. So I waited, and then round after that, I qualified seventh. It was much better. But again, I'm just playing that catch-up game to where I could do half of the moto at a good speed, and then the other half was just survival mode. And so that's where I was like, hey, I can show you guys I got the speed, but I can't get that result because I just can't put in that many amount of laps with this little preparation. And so that's where I was. It's just, I wish I could go back in time and I would have gotten a bike right after I came back from this Nations, and I would have gotten a few months of preparation. But at the time, I was almost sure that I was going to be headed to Europe again for a full season.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And like how you mentioned, it's a catch-up game from there, only getting a ride a few times before even the East season took off, and that was Privateer Yamaha, and then going to the Honda team. And, dude, Nashville, I was at Nashville. That track was super gnarly, and then obviously New York was super ruddy and kind of sketchy too, so I'm sure it's even harder to jump in when the tracks are pretty tough like that.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, it's a little bit harder in Supercross compared to Motocross as well when you're jumping in a new bike, because Supercross is all about being precise and just hitting your marks, where Motocross, you can just almost hold it wide and find your limits, you know? And so I would say you need to know your bike a whole lot better for Supercross. And that's where I wasn't one with the bike. And talking about New Jersey, second qualifying, I was able to get my name on the board. You know, I got fifth on that second qualifier, which I had not done in quite a while. And so that was like also a good motivational thing for myself, you know, because let's be honest, it's a struggle moment for my career. And after all these struggles and all the things that have been going on, it's good to at least know that the speed's there. One, I don't have the backup that I needed for a preseason, and I didn't have a preseason at all. And that's kind of the boat I've been the last few years. And it sounds like an excuse for those of you that are listening, but I mean, let's be honest. Stewart couldn't make a comeback. Yeah. Who am I to make one with 2 days of riding, show up to a Supercross and get a podium? You know, I don't even think anybody out there, no one, could show up to a race with just 2 or 3 days of preparation on a dirt bike and get a podium. Regardless of how fit they are off of the bike, it's a whole different game when you get on a dirt bike. I mean, I have never done as much cardio I have done in my entire life. Since I went to Europe, I trained with a bunch of different people when I was there. Yamaha had their personal trainer when I was out there. I learned a whole lot. And I have not stopped doing cardio at least once a day, if not twice. So I'm the fittest I've ever been in my life. But that doesn't mean that I can last the longest on a moto. You know, I have been a lot less fit in the past when it comes to actual physical aspects and VO2 max and whatnot, and I was able to last longer in the moto because it's just a complete different game. Motocross itself is a unique sport, and there's nothing you can do in a gym that is gonna just make you bike fit, if that makes sense.
No, it definitely does. And like you said, like comparing to Stewart, like even this year, Osborne, who came in halfway, he struggled for the first like 4 or 5 rounds just because he didn't have that time on the bike. And then obviously at the end of the season, you start to, you know, pick up his results, but it just goes to show you, like, there's nothing that can replicate a gate drop, and there's nothing that can replicate bike time. If you have an injury, let's say you have an arm injury, you can still go out and run and stuff like that, but it's, you might be as fit as you can ever be, but to be able to go out there and have enough seat time is like the main thing, I feel like.
Yeah, for sure. Your brain's got to be in sync with the bike. You got to have that muscle memory of going fast. You can't just build it overnight. And something that I also was taught, and it makes complete sense when I was in Europe, is like, you win your championships or your races in the off season, not during the season. So it's like, at least in Europe, you race 2 days. You know, you race Saturday and Sunday, and it's outdoors. It's brutal out there when it comes to fitness. So when my teammates were riding twice a week, because they were already fit, they had their bike set up perfectly, I was having to ride 4 days a week between the races. So I was gaining throughout the week, but then by the time second moto came on Sunday, I was a lot more tired than my teammates, you know, because they were at a stage where they were able to just work on speed and maintain fitness, where I was building fitness. But in order to build fitness, you're going to have to be tired at some point.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And you talked about going over to Europe. How did that whole deal transpire? And did you like, obviously it sounds like you really enjoyed yourself over there and you put in some really good results. How did that whole deal come about? What team were you riding for?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, like, it was the same Anthony Rodriguez. It wasn't anyone else. But when I was out there, I had a mechanic. I had a suspension guy with me. I had the trainer that was with me 24/7, basically. The team owner was going far beyond he was supposed to do to make me comfortable at a country that I had never been at, mm-hmm. helping me find a place, a car, everything. My main and only focus there was riding a dirt bike. And that's how the team made it be. The team made it to where if you were not doing the greatest you could, it was totally on you, because everything that I was surrounded by was 8+. And with that being said, I'll go back to your question. And how did I find that? Basically, I was in Vegas after a terrible season that I did with KTM. It was nobody's fault. I mean, I had some crashes, some stuff people don't know behind the doors. I wasn't able to train. Long story short, it was a bad season. It really was. And at that point, you know, economically, I wasn't doing well. I was really bad. And to be honest, I had even told my girlfriend, like, hey, this might be my last race. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to die when I'm 85 and still be able to go on the weekends and ride a dirt bike. You know, I will always have a dirt bike. But economically, I thought at that point that that might have been my last race. And then before the main event started, I got an email from a guy that was trying to help me when it comes to trying to find a ride in Europe. And he told me that he had gotten something for me. And so that was mind-changing from going in the same day that I thought, let's go out there, do the best I can tonight at Las Vegas, because this might be my last race, to, wow, I got an opportunity now to go show myself. That night at Vegas, I did not know what the extent of the contract was going to be. All I know is that the Sunday after Vegas, I booked my flight for Tuesday without knowing how long my contract was going to be. I didn't know if it was going to be a 2-race-long filling ride. I didn't know if it would be a 6-race. I did know that the guy that had gotten injured had done his knee. And we all know that ACL usually takes between 4 and 6 months.
Yeah.
But there was rumors about him not getting it fixed and just trying to muscle through it. And so that's where I go again, and I'm like, it might just be a 3-race filling. You never know, but I'm just going to take the opportunity and do the best I can. And so, yeah, the Tuesday after Vegas, after I thought I was going to be probably done racing, I'm flying to Europe. And I get there, I think, the Wednesday. I go ride at a local track on Thursday, and then Saturday I was racing in Germany. And qualifying, I think there was 32 riders or something like that. I forgot how many riders there was. All I know is I only beat one rider. And you could tell the whole entire factory team were just looking at me like, yeah, who is this kid? We kind of just made a mistake. And, yeah, I knew I just learned the bike. I think it was like 48th that I was qualified on or something. All I know is I got 12th that day with just 1 day of riding mm-hmm. the bike. And so it was pretty good. The team realized what kind of rider I was, that I was a racer and that I didn't slow down until the checkered flag was shown. And I was really, really, really lucky to come across the Kamiya team in my journey as a rider, because it opened my eyes with a lot of things. And it showed that with a good team surrounding me, I was able to go from qualifying 40th and finishing 12th to getting top five in a world championship round,
yeah.
You know, and battling with former champion Jorge Prado and Thomas Covington himself. He was flying when he was there, you know, and as well as Paul Jonas. And for me to be able to see that I can go just as fast as those guys without a preseason, it's just mind-blowing for me, and it has changed the way I think about this sport. And I have told my girlfriend multiple times and my family, I'm going to probably either make it as a professional motocrosser or end up sleeping underneath a bridge because I went broke trying.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's like the story with the, you know, a lot of people coming up too. It's so tough in the sport. And it's, you mentioned earlier, like, unfortunately you had to get bumped up to that 450 class because of the age rule. And that, man, that just sounds like such a bummer, especially for a guy like you. It was your first year over there. You obviously showed your results. You can do well. And it kind of sucks with that age rule they have over there, because you probably, I would assume you would have got a pretty good 250 ride over there if you could have rode the class.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Factory Kamiya Yamaha team, they were super happy with me. The team owner, more than the team owner, he's a good friend of mine. Like, now, after I just met him when I went there, I didn't know who the guy was, but they're a really caring person. And he said it's a shame you did not come to Europe 2 years ago, because we would have made you a top three rider and a championship contender if you would have been able to train the way you have for multiple years in a row. And yeah, it's a shame, because I had two factory teams actually come up to me and ask for my birthday, because they were wondering if I could do another year or not. And not just that, I mean, the industry itself were so impressed with my performance in such a short time that most, if not all of them, thought I was going to get a 450 ride, including myself. There was actually, we were dealing to go on a 450 team that was going to basically be almost built just for me. And it was going to be one 450 rider and two European championship riders. But then they changed the age rule for the European championship as well, which used to be ageless. And then they changed that, and the team was not going to just have one rider in 450. So that pedal. But yeah, that's the way it was going to go. And I was really close to making that happen. And unfortunately, the FIM changing those rules abruptly like that, I just kind of was a stab on the back to myself.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that kind of messed some other guys up too. I think like Marshall Welton, I know, because he was starting to really come on strong over there too. And Covington, that's the, you know, the reason he decided to come over here as well. So it's a bummer to see.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's,
I mean, Covington had another year, and I'm pretty sure he could have done awesome things. But, yeah, Marshall Welton, and there were another few guys also that had to move out from Europe. But, I mean, I cannot talk bad about FIM because they really do good, put an amazing race. There's a few talks about the way they handle things. Yes, we're all going to see our things that we don't like. But regardless of the things that we see that we don't like, they do put a good show. They do a good job showing the public races. You know, your USA is doing it now where you can do it online and see it from wherever you are and stuff. I think that's a really good thing. You know, it's a really good event they got going, that's for sure, especially when they go overseas and stuff. This whole show is put on really good. But the age thing, I do have to agree that I don't see the reasoning behind that, because let's just look at Zach Osborne, bring his name back. I think he's 28 or something like that. He won his 250 championship when he was 27.
Yeah.
So that's 5 years after he wouldn't have been able to race 250s in Europe. People like Alex Martin, you know, they're a lot smaller than the average rider. For him, it might be harder to ride a 450, you know? So if he was in Europe, his career might have been over 8 years ago.
Yeah.
So those are the things that I don't quite understand. And I never will, but it's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's really, we can sit here and talk about it. There's not, really not too much you can do about it. Moving on from that, though, I know you're down in Florida. Any plans to do some nationals this summer, maybe WW?
So basically the same way as Supercross was going, I was supposed to try and get something working with Tyloop to do some selected rounds. Unfortunately, they were not able to do that. And so then again, I was left without a bike, just doing a ton of cycling and gym and workout. I have two friends that race downhill professionally, Nico Mulally and Dakota Norton. And my friend Jack Burr, who films them, invited me to go racing downhill with them. And it was pretty cool to see the way they do their thing and how gnarly these guys are. I was actually able to race, and I was, I think, 16 seconds off of their pace or something like that. But it was still really cool to do. I mean, I raced a factory bike from Dakota Norton at the Vinci, and I was able to win my class. And with my lap 10, I would have been top 8 in the pro class. Of course, it's not a huge race, but it was still fun to do while still doing some workouts. And I really do think it might help motocross, because your reaction time and the way you see those rocks coming at you, everything kind of can be implemented into motocross. And so after that race was done, I got a phone call from a friend of mine, Pablo, who owns PHX. And he was like, why don't we just get something together for you to try and do WW, since it's close to Florida. Mm-hmm. And so I went down to Miami as soon as I got back from North Carolina. I got the bike from him. I started riding a few days. Unfortunately, the fork seal broke, so I had to send it out. So I was down there a few days just, again, doing gym. And I just got back to Cairo, Georgia. Well, I live in Tallahassee, Florida, but I got back to Cairo, Georgia yesterday with the bike. And David Walls and I are framing it, putting it ready for me to train this week and go racing in WW and see how good I can do. I got my hopes higher than I did for Supercross because of what I said earlier.
Yeah.
I think Supercross, you have got to be one with your bike. You have got to be able to know what that bike is going to do seconds before it happens. Where in motocross, I think it's more of a fitness thing, and you can be able to get away with a whole lot more without knowing the bike. So I'm coming with that open mindset that I can do a whole lot better. I'm staying very positive. I've got no reason to not be happy with my riding skills after doing what I did in Europe. And the amount of hours I put on top of a dirt bike while I was in Europe were a whole lot. So I don't think that these few weeks of not riding should affect me that much. So yeah, I'm just going there and trying to do my best. My main goal is just to cross that checker flag, satisfied with the way I raced that day.
Yeah, I was following you on social media, and I saw you riding that sand pit out by the stadium in Miami Gardens, and I've ridden that a couple of times, and that place was super gnarly. So I was kind of hoping that was like some training for WW coming up.
Yeah, that's what it was exactly. I mean, Miami is hot, man, and it was humid there. And this sand is the driest sand I've ever rode with some gnarly rollers. So doing a 30-minute moto there was something that was a struggle. I was able to do them, which I was impressed with myself, because I felt like all this training I'm doing off the bike is paying off. Mm-hmm. And like I said, on outdoors, it's a different game, and I was able to get away with a little more. But at the same time, it's kind of like in the middle of the hood for what I hear.
Yeah.
And at least there's like a police station a few blocks away. But it's crazy how it's in the middle of a pretty well-known city.
Yeah.
And there's no release that you have to sign. There's no form. It's nothing. It's just like
a sand pit.
An empty lot. It's an empty lot with a bunch of rollers and sand that you can make your own turn track. And yeah, it's an amazing training place. After that video that I posted, actually Forrest Butler from Rocky Mountain KTM team texted me, because he grew up in Miami, and he was like, man, I do not know why you're there. That is like the most dangerous place in Miami. I grew up there seeing like fire shots from gangs between and stuff like that. But then again, he did tell me, you know what, I should probably take all that back, because I was like 20 years ago. There's probably bling neighborhoods that are being built around, and it's probably a whole different game. But yeah, that sand pit is known for being like the ghettoest area in Miami.
Yeah, it's I've like gone obviously to go watch the Dolphins and stuff at the stadium, just being and then to ride there as well a long time ago. But yeah, it's not one of the nicer neighborhoods, and you know, with so many dirt bikes are on the road nowadays, it's kind of sketchy to bring one out. But hey, it worked out for you.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, I wasn't going there alone by myself.
Yeah.
I went there with another rider and stuff, you know, trying to be a little cautious about the situation. And yeah, nothing bad happened. There was actually a guy who pulled up and watched me ride for a little while. And it's pretty funny, too, because you can see the cars slow down because it's literally right next to a very busy road. And it's just cool. Something to see the motocross can be done that way, still on the city.
Yeah.
It's just a cool feeling, is, you know, with all the law enforcement, with the sound barriers and whatnot, none of that was seen down there.
Yeah, definitely cool. Let's take it way back here, Anthony. Obviously born in Venezuela, when did you first come over to the United States?
So I believe it was 2009 Winter Games.
Okay.
And basically, this sounds harsh, but I was getting bored of riding in Venezuela, because it was, since I was like 7 years old, my dad had built this track that I rode until I was 13. And it was just like, I could ride that track with my eyes closed, basically, over and over and over. And I was like bugging my dad, like, hey, we got to go to USA. I see all these pictures. The tracks look so fun. And basically, that was the main reason that brought me here. I mean, yes, we were pretty competitive. My dad trained me every Tuesday and every Thursday. We would do long motos. There would be like 8 races a year to do the national championship, and luckily I was winning those. Every now and then, my dad would take me to a South American race. But it was never like, hey, let's go to the USA. I could make a living out of this. It was like, dad, take me to the USA so I can enjoy riding. I want to know what a rock feels like. I want to know what a sand berm is like. And so he took me to the Winter Ams on a 85, and things went well. I did it pretty good. I think I won 2 classes of that Florida Regional Winter Ams, whatever you want to call it. And some people advised my dad, you know, that maybe he should try and send me out here for a year and see if I could improve to a point where it could be a smart idea to leave me out here and try and make a career out of this, because obviously Venezuela was already going on a downhill where people were leaving the country, whether they had a career in another country or not. So I wasn't going to lose anything by going here. If anything, I was going to learn English, which would help you at a country like Venezuela. And at the same time, I was living a dream, you know, and lucky enough, I was able to meet Colleen Millsaps, which made everything a lot easier, because if it wasn't for a facility like MTF, it would have been impossible for me to move to the USA, because, I mean, we would have been talking about getting a house, a truck, a place for me to drive, et cetera, where I went to MTF with my dad for 2 months, I think it was, and he put me in the motorhome. He made it to where I was settled, and then he left to go to Venezuela so he could continue to work, so he could continue to pay the bills, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And because of a facility like that, I was able to move to USA and pursue my dream.
Yeah, that is awesome. And I remember like watching, this was like when Verb Moto, I feel like, was in its prime, just videos from MTF and stuff. Who were some of the people you were riding with down there at Millsaps?
I was like on the younger class, like just below Savachi and Cal Peters. Those were the guys that were like a few steps ahead of me. And then right there with me, I would say, was Dakota Alex, Jordan Smith, and people that would come and go, of course, but those were the ones that were there basically the whole time. Keith Docker as well, he was extremely fast. And, you know, every year somebody would just step it up and be right behind you, if not in front of you. So it was like constantly, we were all just pushing each other.
Yeah, that's gotta, like, I know even at any level of, you know, dirt bike racing, if you ride with other people that are fast or even faster than you, it's obviously going to help you. Do you think that helped you a lot, you know, growing up at, or, you know, doing your amateur career at Millsaps with all these other fast guys? I'm sure you guys push each other's level all the time.
Oh yeah, for sure. Especially with the way I used to ride a dirt bike, I was extremely reckless. I was not scared to hold it wide, but I had zero technique because, of course, in Venezuela, we didn't know if what we were doing was wrong or right. All we did was put in the time. There was no put your elbows up, put your toes in, do this, look ahead. There was no technique involved with my training in Venezuela until I moved here. And so I feel like that was the main and probably the only reason that I was able to get better was because I completely changed the way I rode to a position where I was able to go faster. And when I was able to go faster, then what I had to do was follow the faster guys and see how much longer they were holding it, where they were breaking, what type of lines they were doing. So it's like whatever you're training with, you're going to try and race to that level for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely sounds like you guys are always out there pushing it. So you did the whole Loretta Lynn thing and all that. You were a Star Yamaha as an amateur, right? Maybe at least the last year.
Yeah, so 2012, I was able to win Loretta's for JGR on a Yamaha. And then we were talking to Star Racing before that week. And after that week, we sealed the deal. So I had an amateur year with Star, starting from 2012 Minios. And I was supposed to do Loretta's on the A class, which didn't happen because I did my ACL before. And so basically my amateur year with Star, all I did was the Spring Nationals.
Okay.
And then get ready on Supercross to go racing with him.
Okay. All right, yeah, I think I met you a long time. This is probably like 2013 down at Miami MX. I thought I remember it was a Star bike, but yeah, it definitely makes sense now.
Yeah, for sure. It must have been one of my first rides with the team as well.
Yeah, I believe so.
Or with their bike at least.
Well, all right, man. Before I let you go, who do you want to thank for helping you out all these years and getting you out there?
Well, I definitely have to thank, my girlfriend and her family. They've been very supportive, as well as Colleen Millsap and the entire Millsap Training Facility crew. Those are the guys that have stick with me through the downs of the downs and the highs of the highs, as well as my family. They are not understanding what I'm saying, but I got to thank my dad, my mom, and my brother. They've always been very supportive, They gave it all for me, and they're still in that country that unfortunately is not in a good place right now. But every day I pray that they can be safe, and I thank them for what they did. And I just look forward to being able to join the team again so that I can get an off season and give it my best, because I'm not done, and I just want to be able to show the world that I got what it takes. And I have to thank Pablo at PHX as well, because he's giving me a hand for me to be able to race WW and hopefully some other rounds. And so yeah, I need to thank all these people, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some of them, but yeah, I need to thank all of them.
Well, awesome, man. And thank you very much for coming on. And I'll be at WW, so I'll make sure to swing by and say what's up.
All right, man. Thanks a lot. Appreciate doing this interview. And I hope the show gets a lot of views.
What's up, guys? We've got some exciting news as our sponsor, Blood Lubricants, continues to push the bar with high-quality products. In addition to their already outstanding racing oil, they've added fork and shock fluid, gear oil, chain lube, kick-ass degreaser, detailer, and pre-race spray. Whether you have a UTV, Harley, ATV, or dirt bike, Blood Lubricants has you covered. They're offering sponsorship opportunities from the amateur level to the pro level, and they're already sponsoring top privateers like Tyler Bowers, Henry Miller, and Bubba Pauly. Racing is in their blood. But that's not all. They want to hook you guys up as well. Head on over to bloodlubricants.com. That's BLUD lubricants.com, and use promo code WHISKEY for 25% off your order. No need to rewind it. I'll say it again. 25% off your order with promo code WHISKEY at bloodlubricants.com. Jeff Green hooking you guys up. High quality stuff. Check it out. Back to the show. All right, on the line with me right now is the owner of Task Racing. It's Mark Slover. What's up, dude?
How you doing, Kurt?
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm still recovering from that 24-hour Perry Mountain Challenge, but I'm doing good.
Yeah, they're extremely taxing events for sure.
Oh yeah, my hands are nice and calloused up, and my back is still aching, but it was definitely worth it.
I was gonna say, plus all that humidity down there, it just sucks the life right out of you. But most of the time, when people finish those races, they're asking when the next race is, what dates, because they want to lock it in. It's crazy.
That's exactly. It was fun, but I didn't realize how fun it was until like my drive home, and I was like, man, that was awesome. I can't wait till next year.
Yeah, you're so exhausted driving back that you're kind of like in a comatose state, and then you're finally, you know, after you get a nice shower, get some food in you, a couple beers, you're like, wow, I just accomplished something really unique, and I want to do it next year.
Exactly, man. But hey, let's start this off. What is TASK Racing?
So we are a motorcycle helmet light and light bar retailer, in addition to some other kind of niche products. The company was kind of founded on using lights for enduro and hard enduro. And I started out with the lights and have kind of grown the product base, and now I'm starting to branch out into some other areas that are not really electronics, but they are niche products for, you know, people that do these enduros and even motocrossers. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it's definitely, like you said, a niche product line, or a, you know, niche company.
Yeah.
Off-road dirt bike riding at night, but it definitely, I saw a bunch of TASK stickers and a bunch of people running TASK lights 2 weeks ago in Perry Mountain.
Yeah.
So it definitely seems like it's going well. What is your background in the sport of motocross? Did you grow up riding? Where did you grow up and all that sort of thing?
Well, I grew up in California and actually started on the roadside. I started road racing kind of at the age of 18 or so. And so up until probably about 25 years old, I was into street bikes. And then my brother was kind enough to put some money down and get us our first, quote, dirt bikes, which were two YZ 490s, which is ridiculous. But that was a high place to start. And we started really enjoying ourselves out there in the dirt and kind of gaining some skills. And then it just kind of bloomed from there. And I've been riding ever since. So for the last 20 plus years, been riding.
Yeah, I rode a YZ 490 one time, and it was an absolute monster. I think it was like an 85, and it was insane.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what we had. And, you know, it was kind of funny. You know, you start out on that huge bike with huge power. It's really unusable in the woods. Mm-hmm. I kept dropping in CC. I went from like a 490 down to a 400, down to a 250, down to a 200, down to a 150, and now I'm kind of working my way back up.
I got you.
As I get older.
Yeah, that's...
So it's kind of fun.
That's funny. That's, you know, I race hair scrambles from Florida. I live in North Carolina now, and that seems to be how it's been lately too for a lot of people. As you know, they were riding 450s, and then they've gone to 350s, 300s, and now a lot of people are on 250s. I think just as these bikes progress and get faster and faster, you kind of have to get the smaller model each year.
Well, it's there's something about, like, I love your the start of your show, the whiskey throttle on in the two stroke.
Yeah.
That sound of that two stroke, because I had a 125 for a while, and I was just pinned constantly in the woods, and it was so athletic. I mean, you had to do so much to just keep this thing kind of square and from getting bent out of shape. And I would ask my friends, I'm like, man, I must be flying.
Yeah.
They're like, no, you're not. I'm like, really? It just feels like I'm just going super, super fast. And it's like, so ever since then, I've started to step up the CCs and realize that, you know, from point A to point B, that's where I need to be fast. I can outbrake and out accelerate some of these guys, but I need to have the CCs to do that.
Yeah, definitely. When did you start TASK Racing? When was like the first year of being in business?
We started in March of 2013, and it was actually our first experience. It was right after we had done the previous year. We had done the 2012. We did Perry Mountain. My brother obtained a VCR type of tape that had Perry Mountain 24-hour challenge, and it was really, there weren't many of them going on at that point in time. So, he brought that back. He said, "We got to do this." And I said, that sounds like a lot of fun. So we just kind of makeshifted our way, just got some cheap helmet lights and not a very effective bike light. And we did it. We actually ended up doing a duo team, which was really tough, not being in full motocross shape and our first time at an event like that. I think we put down about 150 miles each person, but that was tough. That was tough, but it kept me coming back. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, that was another. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, yeah. So I was going to say, it kept me coming back, and we started to think, my brother and I started to think. So task racing, that's actually short for something. And my brother came up with the name. And the logo and everything. And ASK actually stands for Thomas A. Slover's Kids.
Okay.
And so my brother and I kind of started this whole thing up, and we thought, wouldn't it be interesting to start up a helmet light company? And we had so much fun doing it. I can't see how more people wouldn't want to do these 24-hour races. So we started in, and started obviously very, very small. I came up with the idea of the GoPro mounted helmet light. I came up with that whole thing, which is since a lot of a few competitors have kind of taken as well. And it was a good design for its time, but there were a lot of weaknesses in it. So a few years down the road, after selling and kind of growing with the product, we're always continually trying to innovate and change and tweak and make better. And that's kind of when we decided, look, there's too many issues with these GoPro styles. So we're going to go proprietary and redesign a whole new mount system. And that mount system's been in place for probably a little over 2 years right now. So, and it seems to be going great. I have not yet had one come back to me.
Really? That's awesome. Especially with electronics, that's probably really hard to do.
It's they're all made out of 100% polycarbonate, so they're unbreakable. Mm-hmm. And very clever design. I have a friend, and he's an engineer by trade, and he's also my riding buddy. We ride every Sunday with a big group of guys, and he is the mastermind of this design. He came up with, we talk about what we're hoping to achieve, and he just comes up with some really incredible things. And and then we just implement it and move forward from there.
Yeah, I think my favorite part about the light is the little tabs that you can like screw and unscrew to shift the angle. That's amazing. Yeah. Because it is so, everyone rides so differently. Some people have their helmets up higher. Some people ride with their helmets down low. I personally look way ahead. So to be able to adjust the light, that was huge, because someone else didn't have a task racing light that they're parked next to us. And I could just see the way it was angled. It wasn't really shining. It was shining more up than it was like on the trail. So it was definitely something really cool that I liked about your guys' product.
Yeah, that's literally all in the design. I mean, that was part of it. One was to have a four-way adjustable type of mount, and that is, if you think about it, so it's got that heavy-duty Velcro snap lock that adjusts your horizontal, and that channel allows the light to pivot up and down with really just turning a thumb screw. And as you're riding along, the elements change. You get into a straightaway, and you want to actually be pointed a little bit more up. Mm-hmm. So with your hand without tools, you know, you can just quickly adjust that. By creating that mount, it reduced a lot of our issues, which was broken mounts. I mean, there was one year at the Northeast 24 Hour, which is coming up this next month. There was one corner where there was a low hanging branch, and the GoPro sits up pretty high. I mean, it's a few inches up off the helmet, and it was just it was clipping people's GoPros and breaking them. And if they didn't have duct tape, they'd come back dangling. They'd have no light. They'd come back dangling. And I probably sold, 150. Actually, I probably just gave away 150 just to get them out there again, just in that night. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we just decided, look, let's build a few things. The two issues were the mounts would break and the cords would yank off the circuit board. So we designed a mount that kind of it solves both of those issues. It won't break. The cord will not pull off the circuit board. And if you do get raked or take a big crash, and I've had Baja racers that have crashed at like 75, it'll take a beating. It'll break off your helmet. And without tools, you can pop it right back on and get on your way. So it's really good. It's a really good design.
Yeah, I was gonna say I was shocked. Like I did the Velcro, and putting it on there, yeah. I was like, I might need to like tape this thing down, and I'm not too sure. And then once I got it on the GoPro and got it nice and when I got on the Velcro and got it nice and like packed down, that thing was not coming off for nothing.
Yeah. So it's like a 2.5 square inch mm-hmm. little tab that you get. And each inch holds 10 pounds.
Okay.
So you think about, if you snap it on and it's hooked up well, you can grab the light and just shake your helmet freely and it ain't coming off unless you crash or get really raked by a tree. It is designed to break off, though, mm-hmm. if you get in a bad situation.
Yeah.
So you kind of protect the light, you know?
Okay.
So, but they're a lot of fun. It makes the thing about, and you experience this, it just makes, you spent multiple hours on that track during the day, and then at night you popped on that helmet light and a bike light, and it's like, holy cow, this is a totally different place. Mm-hmm. And you're like lost. It's a whole new world. And to me, that's like the biggest thing about night riding, is that all those same trails that you've done over and over during the day, you ride every weekend, you do that at night, and it's, you get a little bit confused, and then you do those things backwards and you're flat out lost, and it just makes it like you're riding new trails. It's awesome.
Yeah, so my third session was like 4:30 in the morning. We were doing two laps each, and my first lap was completely in the dark, and then the second lap is the sun started to come up, and I was like, is this even the same trail? Like, it's amazing how different it is riding mm-hmm. in the day versus the night.
That's the best time. Right when being on that shift, because you get this flood of energy when that sun starts to come up.
Exactly.
You get real fast. So, I get that. The nice thing about when you got your helmet lights on, they always say to look up, look forwards, mm-hmm. look far. And the helmet lights really accentuate that. And you end up getting like blinders, like a racehorse would have, and my lap times are almost always faster at night than they are during the day, because I don't think about any of the roots and trees. I just kind of point and shoot, you know?
Yeah,
it's fun.
We had this guy, his name's Corey, was on our team, and his mm-hmm. lap times were, I think they were less than a minute slower at night, and so we were calling mm-hmm. the owl, and he honestly came back, and he was just like, He wears glasses normally, but he doesn't ride with them because they dry out or with his contacts. Mm-hmm. So he just said, at night, I just couldn't see anything. So I just rode. And I think that's what it was. He just didn't see all the trees, didn't see all the roots and all the bumps, and it kind of helped him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always good to not know mm-hmm. what's out there. Sasquatch could be out there, so it's not good.
Yeah. So we talk about the helmet lights, but you guys also make a ton of different light bars. Talk about that a little bit. How much later after the helmet lights did these come out?
They came out probably about a year after. And that was because we were constantly, I'm just always testing different things out. And what I learned was that the helmet lights are really effective just alone. And they're cheaper as well. And most of the time I'll just recommend to people, look, if you're getting into this, that's great. I think that's great. And, you know, don't start out big because the systems, yeah. You know, the light bar systems are more expensive. And frankly, it's way more important to have the light on your head because everywhere you look, you got light. Mm-hmm. And when you're going around a corner fast, say a left-hander, if you're really pitching it, your front wheels are kind of pointing to the right and you don't see anything in front of you. You're trying to look through the corner and into the next. That's why you want it on your head. So, but after I started experimenting with the bike lights and different light bars, I realized, wow, these two combined just give you huge light. And so I started thinking, this is kind of interesting. The whole key for us was trying to come up with some kind of a mounting system because there aren't too many companies out there that do mounting systems that are effective. And we've always been of the opinion, like, function before fashion. So our standard light bar kit is just got simple stainless steel mounting tabs that have a lot of adjustability, are strong. They can be bent. And if you crash, they can be re-bent back into shape. And then we've got some really fancy, which is kind of a newer thing that we have, but we've started to get into more CNC machine work and creating some really interesting fork-mounted light bar systems. And they're all very simple. We have anywhere from just 100% rechargeable, just like the helmet lights are. We have rechargeable light bar systems, and we also have, we call them hardwire, which attach to your electric start battery. And they just add a lot of light, and they add just that much more joy to the process.
Yeah, it's like you said, Dan, there's a ton of different stuff on here. Function before fashion. You guys have it all, and I could definitely see. I think if I do it next year, I'm going to have to get a light bar. I just had the helmet light, so it'll make it that much better.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll go a little bit faster at night. You talk about you're always testing, always coming up with new innovative products. What are some products you're looking at making now? And talk about these goggles too. I noticed you guys have goggles on here, the airflow goggles. What are those all about?
So that's like my latest and greatest. So that I don't know if you've done enduro before, you know, when it gets kind of humid and wet and sticky out there, goggles, you start to overheat and you start to create fog. And I don't care. I've got like $170 Oakleys that the first thing they do is start fogging.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's really hard to find a goggle that doesn't do that. And quite a few years ago, I used to do a lot of the Grand National cross country races.
Okay.
And when it was kind of nasty out there, I saw that guys were making their own mesh goggles. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're basically stitching them together, gluing them, but they're just kind of a mesh. And what that allows is that air to flow through, and they would never fog on you. But the bad thing is that you still got to get a lot of stuff in your eyes. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, you know, a lot of enduro guys, when it gets nasty like that, they take off their goggles and they wear safety glasses. And I started thinking, boy, and I had already figured out a way to make these mesh goggles, and I just couldn't get my arms around, you know, putting something out there. And at like 3 a.m, it hit me on this safety goggle idea that the reason why they work is because there's constant airflow around them, but they don't really protect your face all that well. And they will get knocked off your face if you're just wearing glasses. So I started thinking, wow, this would be
be interesting if there was like kind of a dual goggle lens that allowed that airflow to flow kind of like a convection flow through the goggle to prevent the fogging, and also allow that heat to escape. I think that's the key thing, is allow that heat to escape. And I developed these things, and they've since just continued to develop. I mean, even this last week, I did some developments on it. And I'll be doing roll-off systems with them. I'll be doing, right now it's tear-offs, and I'll be doing iridium lenses, gold and blue. It'll be kind of mm-hmm. cool. But the bottom line is, and this is what I think the company in general tries to do. Like, I don't really want to put something out there that doesn't work. These things work. They're not a gimmick. It's like they friggin' flat out work. And I've got a lot of pros using them right now. They're out. I've been getting them out to my pros, and I've heard nothing but great feedback. So they're kind of a niche goggle. You know, they're mm-hmm. they're $55 retail, which is pretty short money for a niche goggle that works. And I think the roll-offs will probably be in that $85-$90 range. But I haven't yet released those yet. I'm still kind of making some tweaks on those.
Okay.
But yeah, they flat out work. And the feedback that I've gotten from people is that, wow, these keep you cooler. They keep you less fatigued, which because of that airflow, it's kind of like riding without your goggles.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you follow the hard enduro stuff, but if you look at Erzberg and you look at Tennessee Knockout, pretty much like a fifth of the way into the race, if not sooner, goggles are off.
Yeah, I have noticed
because
that.
You're already you're fogged up and you're overheating like hell at that point, as is your bike. So this is a way to be able to protect your eyes and keep your goggles on and get through the race just fine.
Sounds awesome. Sounds like something I would need back in Florida. I remember going out for practices, and you got all the classes out there at once, and you're a lot of sitting around, especially if it's sloppy. So, yeah, definitely sounds like a great product.
Yeah, the only thing that they're not good for, and this is tested, is they're not good for dusty days because there's so much airflow that stuff does get in your eyes. And then they're not good for out here where I am. We stud up in the winter, and it's powdery out there, powder tends to get packed in between the two lenses, so that's not a great solution.
Yeah.
But it's okay. So it works for. I pretty much wear them all the time now. If it's as long as it's not a dusty day, and they work phenomenal.
Oh yeah, it sounds awesome. So another thing I want to ask you, Mark, and I don't know if this is just because social media has become so popular and pretty much everyone is on it. But do you think these 24 hours or even just the night racing is starting to grow? Because I feel like I see a lot more of it now than I used to.
Totally. Same with the Sprint Enduro series. So those are and the hard enduro races. American Hard Enduro AHE has now a series of like, I think, five or six races, the Ozark and Ozark 100 Miler in Missouri and the Rev Limiter and Tennessee Knockout, and I forget the other races, but those are definitely growing, the 24 hours and the night race series. We started out primarily supporting MRAN, which is in Nevada, and they have like a 6-7 race, maybe it's even up to nine races, but these local clubs, they do night race series. You know, they have their Sunday races, and on Saturday nights, they do a night race. And those are becoming a lot more common. And I've seen more 24 hours and endurance races kicking up. So it's a field that's growing because it's just variety. It's variety. It's a unique experience, and people, you got to admit, there is so much energy around there in those pits. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was,
you know,
it's awesome being there 3 a.m. and everyone's still out at their pit having a good time.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a unique experience that not many riders get to experience, but that's you know, that's usually the people that do it convince their other 5 friends to do it the next year. I mean, the Northeast 24 hour, Perry Mountain had apparently a really good showing this year. And Northeast 24 was sold out in like 3 days,
oh,
800
wow.
riders.
Jesus.
So, yeah, yeah. And there's the Glen Helen, and there's the Baja 1000, and there's Starvation Ridge, and the Gutbuster 24 hour. So this is like my exciting time, because these are when all the 24-hour races are.
Yeah,
so you know?
Definitely makes you feel good, I bet, when you see more and more of these pop up.
Totally. And to be honest, I mean, that's the fun part of my job, you know, because I get to – we're a little bit different. We don't work with distributors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get to talk to guys like you. I get to talk to – you know, your average Joe that has lots of questions, has never ever done one of these races, has never ridden at night, or wants to ride with his son after work, you know, as the days get shorter. And that, to me, is the wicked fun part, because these people are, you know, they're just excited to try something new and different and be able to kind of spend time with their buddies and enjoy something unique. And I really like that. I'm a customer service guy. If you look at anything on my website or any kind of social media, you know, I usually get pretty high marks because I like the people.
Yeah.
I like the people, and I have fun doing it. So why not, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So last question before I let you go here, Mark. If you didn't own Task Racing, weren't doing this company, what would you be doing for work and with your life if there was no dirt bikes?
If there was no dirt bikes,
yeah.
Oh my God. Now it's become such a big part of my life, not just from a business sense, but I mean, I spent 5 hours yesterday ripping with my buddies and working on my technique and trying to corner faster and all that stuff. So it's become like a little bit of an obsession.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure I would have found, you know, something else, maybe road racing. I still want to do that. Adventure biking, that would be great. It's just I'm not ready to move over to that because I think dirt biking is so much more athletic than most, and I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet in this life. So, but it'll probably always have motorcycles in it for sure.
Yeah,
just a matter of if I want to be doing 145 or if I want to be doing 25 through tight trees.
I got you. Yeah, I feel like that's how most of us dirt bike riders are. If there was no dirt bikes, we'd probably be trying to race something else or do something along those lines.
It's such a rush. Actually, I have a 300 four-stroke, a Sherco right now, mm-hmm. and it's a great, great bike. But, you know, I listened to the start of your show, and it there's just something about like a two-stroke. It just gets your adrenaline pumped so high, and so that's where I'm heading next.
Okay.
It's a 300 two-stroke.
I had one
that
of those.
I can let.
It was awesome.
Oh God, they're a lot of hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So that's I'll definitely always be in motorcycles, just as recreational and enjoying them. I like the rush. I like the freedom, and I like the exercise. It's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I think I love it so much. I love dirt biking so much because you get so exhausted out there holding on for like a 20-25 minute stint of just ripping that if you lose focus, you just crash.
Yeah.
So you're forced to pay attention. You can't be a quitter, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, it'll bite you once you start daydreaming out there.
That's right. You can't daydream. You got to be friggin' focused, and you know, just keep it going, keep it revved, keep focused. And if you fail to focus, it's gonna be a painful day.
Exactly. Well, all right, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for the light. It was awesome. Yeah, thank you for everything, man. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. And if anyone has any kind of questions, they can either email Task Racing or feel free to call me up. I love to talk to people just like yourself, and I really appreciate being on tonight.
Awesome, man. You enjoy the rest of your night.
All right, buddy. Thanks, Kurt.
See ya.
Cheers.
Okay. Yeah.